Wow, Brandon, thank you for that introduction. I was like, I mean, fuck. I should have had you write like the promotional materials for and I think you really, you really got it, man. Holy crap. So I'm gonna talk a little bit about the book. Thank you, Steve, for having me. And thank you also to the Poetry Center for hosting me on Thursday as well. Steve was like, okay, so usually we have people read for like half an hour before the event on Thursday. And I was like, oh crap, I need to go longer than I was planning for. And I ended up picking a part of the book right before reading that was really emotional for me, and I like cried on Thursday during the reading, and whoa, it was really tough, but it made me just think about like how deeply these issues hit. And as I mentioned on Thursday, my older brother was given a juvenile life without parole sentence when I was a teenager, and while I was writing the book, his sentence was commuted to 40 years, and it was very stressful, traumatic hearing. And so I think of this book also as an exorcism in some ways. Like it is, social and political critique, but it also includes anecdotes, autobiography, and some creative essays to ventilate the theoretical parts. And so I really just started with observations, looking at the present moment, what is happening with mass incarceration, the criminalization of people of color, predatory fine farming by the police. And then I worked backwards. So I had a set of questions and problems that I wanted to investigate from multiple angles. So I wanted to, write creatively about finance, capital, and mass incarceration. But I also wanted to think theoretically. I wanted to look at political economy, law, discourse. But I also wanted to root it in my personal experiences and observations. And so it's kind of a weird book because it doesn't really fit anywhere. Because some of it might be like a little bit academic, some of it is very personal, some of it is poetry even. The conclusion was inspired by Robin Kelly's book, Freedom Dreams, The Black Radical Imagination. And Robin Kelly, after reading his book, Freedom Dreams, where he writes about the work that the Black Radical tradition has done, not only politically and intellectually, but also creatively. So he writes about Black Surrealism, he writes about Afrofuturism. And so I wanted to use Robin Kelly's, ideas about the Black radical tradition and Black radical imagination to think about the prison abolitionist imagination. Because after I wrote The Nightmare, as Brandon said, I wanted to write The Dream also. And so in the conclusion, I decided to think about the work that poetry can do in denaturalizing the prison. And the ambivalence that I felt around doing that conclusion was like, is this going to trivialize the issues by using aesthetics in the conclusion to think about prison abolition? But ultimately, I really do believe in poetry and the power of the imagination, and poetry can do work, political work around these issues. And so I wanted to carve out that space. And I don't know, you can read the book and, you know, let me know what it does for you. And I know it just came out, so a lot of people haven't gotten a chance to read it yet, but I would love to, you know, talk to you all sometime about it. So I'm gonna read some excerpts from the conclusion, and if you were at the event on Thursday, I'll just read one part that is the same, and the introduction to the concluding chapter, which is The Prison Abolitionist Imagination, A Conversation. The late Mark Fisher once famously said that it's easier to imagine the end of the world than it is to imagine the end of capitalism. The same could be said about prisons. It is easier to imagine the end of the world than it is to imagine a world without prisons. And yet, the modern prison as it currently exists in the US is a fairly recent invention. Florida, which now has one of the largest prison systems in the US, had no physical penitentiaries at the end of the Civil War and had to create its penal system from scratch. Yet, at this historical juncture, prisons have become thoroughly naturalized. Imagining and working toward a world without prisons, which is the project of prison abolition, would not only require us to fundamentally rethink the role of the state in society, but it would also require us to work toward the total transformation of all social relations. A project as lofty as this is easy to dismiss as unrealistic, utopian, impractical, naive, and unrealizable dream. But what if, instead of reacting to these charges with counterarguments that persuasively demonstrate that the abolitionist position is the only sensible position, we instead strategically use these charges as a point of departure to show how the prison itself is a problem for thought that can only be unthought using a mode of thinking that does not capitulate to the realism of the present. Can the re-enchantment of the world be an instrument that we use to shatter the realism of the prison? What follows is a series of questions, conversations with revolutionaries, dead and alive, on death, dreams, the struggle, and the phenomenological experience of freedom. There are moments I want to enter. Will you follow me there, to the place where the breathing walls quietly exhale a low freedom song? One, a dozen roses versus the police state. In From Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation, Kianga Yamata Taylor writes, quote, "In the hours after Mike Brown's body was finally moved, residents erected a makeshift memorial of teddy bears and memorabilia on the spot where the police had left his body. When the police arrived with a canine unit, one officer let a dog urinate on the memorial. Later, when Brown's mother, Leslie McSpadden, laid out rose petals in the form of his initials, a police cruiser whizzed by, crushing the memorial and scattering the flowers. The next evening, McSpadden and other friends and family went back to the memorial site and laid down a dozen roses. Again, a police cruiser came through and destroyed the flowers. Later that night, the uprising began." End quote. I think about how the people gathered after Mike Brown was killed, how they made a makeshift memorial on the blood-stained spot in the road where he had been murdered by the police state. What do I see in this encounter? The will of the people butting up against the police's desire to destroy, to crush all public expressions of grief. The police's show of force is unnecessary, compensatory. They want us to believe that the police cars will always crush rose petals. They tell themselves that their uniform and the power that backs it makes them invulnerable, not like the rose petals arranged in the shape of MB. Erase the memorials, erase the flowers. The people will still rise up. That night, an uprising bloomed out of the ground where the memorial flowers had been crushed. I once read an article about the dreams of dying people. There was a former cop who couldn't stop having nightmares about the people he had violated. He told a hospice nurse that on the job he had done bad stuff. Tormented by his dreams, he gets stabbed, shot, or can't breathe. Eric Garner's last "I can't breathe" circles in time to haunt the officers who take the air out of the world. The cop died with so much regret. The conscious mind of the police officer may be sure of its correctness, but the unconscious mind knows it has done terrible things. The trampling of the memorial flowers is an act of repression, but what you try to blot out and refuse to integrate returns with greater vigor. If I ever met the officers, I would tell them, before you die, you will encounter the lives you took and violated. You driving around in your steel-enclosed fantasy of invincibility, you who must desecrate memorials to prove to yourself you are strong, to hide this weakness of imagination, a police cruiser scattering rose petals. What was it you tried to crush there? Was it a way to blot out awareness of your own death? And yet every time you tried to destroy the memorial, the people returned with objects that bore the memory of Mike Brown. You tried to force the people of Ferguson to forget. The people returned with a will to carry the memory into the streets. Two. Entombed flowers. In 1917, the revolutionary Rosa Luxemburg wrote to her comrade Sophie Leibniz from prison, quote, "Yesterday I lay awake for a long time. I dreamed to myself about various things in the dark. How odd it is that I'm constantly in a joyful state of exaltation without any particular reason. I lie there quietly, alone, wrapped in these many-layered black veils of darkness, boredom, lack of freedom, and winter. And at the same time, my heart is racing with an incomprehensible, unfamiliar inner joy, as though I were walking across a flowering meadow in radiant sunshine. And all the while, I'm searching within myself for some reason for this joy. I find nothing and must smile to myself again and laugh to myself. I believe that the secret is nothing other than life itself. And in the crunching of the damp sand beneath the slow, heavy steps of the sentries, a beautiful small song of life is being sung, if only one knows how to listen properly. At such moments, I think of you, and I would like so much to pass on this magical key to you, so that always and in all situations you would be aware of the beautiful and the joyful, so that you too would live in a joyful euphoria, as though you were walking across a multicolored meadow," end quote. In the dark of the night, you traveled to a colorful meadow, and with your powerful imagination, wove that meadow into a cloak of stars that you imparted to your comrade Sophie to wear as a shield against everything terrible. What bloomed in your mind that night as you lay quietly listening to the boots of the sentries crush the sand? You were sharpening your perceptive faculties so you could tune in to the exalted frequency. You were sensitized by your cell, by the boredom weighing you down, until the pressure of the darkness gave way to an understanding of the deepest mysteries of what it means to be alive, of the connection between desire and politics. I think of your fate, of George Jackson's fate, of Fred Hampton's fate. The state must know when the universe gives birth to a true revolutionary. It must see in them a light it must extinguish, lest their spark find and set alight the divine spark in us all, which would spread until the world as we know it has been upended. Alone in your cell, your body became pure nerve. You were perceiving everything. It made you giddy, the inner joy you felt against the bleak backdrop of the prison. I imagine how you passed the time there, studying political economy and botany, writing letters to your comrades, assembling your herbaria, preparing for the revolution, getting lost in the flowers of your imagination. You were the secret. You were the principle of life itself. You were a tree they had to cut down. 3, planting the dream. In Freedom Dreams, the Black Radical Imagination, Robin D.G. Kelly writes, quote, "What shall we build on the ashes of a nightmare? I won't propose much more, since the design and realization of such a space ought to be a product of a collective imagination, shaped and reshaped by the very process of turning rubble and memory into the seeds of a new society," end quote. I see our shadow in the trees, watching the wheel unfold. I see our one shadow on the wall. I see your restless hand in the spider's thread. I am the ice cave, and there is water, deep blue and white, a light at the bottom. I am equal to my love for you. Let down your hair, willow in the moonlight. The river lulls us into the dream. Nightmares jostle branches in our eyes. I long for the world that is before you, the plate you set on the slate of tomorrow. Your fingers flutter to feel for the grass between the valley, where one foot follows the other into the flaming creek. We don't know what name to give the throbbing stone perched atop the hill. From here, I see for you. Look at what I lost when you were lost, and I could only hear the call of the stones. A body returned floats down the river dressed in candles. I send you the secret while you are asleep. The nights you carried in the length of a strand of hair, the unforgiving flash of his teeth, I stroke your cheek to unlock your jaw and release the rose you carry in your mouth. Your tongue is raw and your mouth is filling with blood. Dear, dear, forgive us for having fallen so far from where you planted the seed, at the bottom of the sea, waiting for the body to ride the stream back to where the rubble gave birth to the first dream. The egg cracks. Night wanders seaward, barefoot in its evening slip. And by this sadness you are shown the path to the holding sea, a trail of somnolent turtles who folded one by one in their grief until a single remained to carry the breath of time back to the seed. Thank you.